You're listening to a proud member of the Dice Tower Network, dedicated to bringing podcasters together for the greater good of gaming. It's sort of like Voltron, but with better lip syncing. Find out more at dicetowernetwork.com.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Family Gamers Podcast. This is episode 189.
Hello, hello, everybody. I am super excited to be here recording another podcast, and especially an odd-numbered episode because we get to talk to someone else and we get to talk to an adult.
Yay! An adult who's not related to us.
Yes, exactly. Welcome, everybody, to the Family Gamers Podcast. As always, I am your host, Andrew, and I am joined by my lovely and wonderful wife, Anitra.
That's me.
And we are joined this week by a very dear internet friend of ours. We've even met in person. It's amazing. We are joined by Jen Bartlett, the board game librarian. How are you doing tonight, Jen?
I'm well. How are you all?
Hanging in there. We're alive. The weather is getting okay. We can be outside as long as we're away from people now, I guess.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
And maybe wearing masks. I don't know.
Yeah, sometimes. We're getting there. So this is episode 189 of the Family Gamers Podcast. Unsurprisingly, I have a fact about the number 189.
All right, hit me.
This came true last October, 2019.
Okay.
October of 2019, a Nepalese man shattered the world record for scaling the 14 highest mountains in the world.
Okay, the record meaning how
the amount of time between the first one and the last one. He did it in 189 days.
Whoa.
That's pretty wild.
That's a pretty cool fact for 189.
Yep. The previous record had been completed in 2013, so 6 years earlier, but it had taken that person 7 years to do it.
Whoa. From 7 years to
a little bit more than 6 months.
Yeah.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that is, sometimes my facts are really good.
Sometimes.
By the way, I was thinking about this today. It actually takes work to come up with like interesting things for these. So
yes.
I'm going to officially say that if you find these number facts interesting, please, please send us a tweet at FamilyGamersAA. Send me an email, Andrew@thefamilygamers.com. If you can give me a number fact for an upcoming episode, I will read that fact and I will give you credit on the show.
Yeah, anywhere.
I think that would be a lot of fun.
Anywhere in like the 190s or the early 200s.
Yeah, within at least five of where we are, it's probably a safe bet. I would love to get some fan feedback on some number facts for what's coming up. That would be a huge help for me.
The gauntlet has been thrown, people.
Whew.
Absolutely. You too, Jen. Just so you know.
That's excellent.
This episode of the Family Gamers Podcast is sponsored by First Move Financial.
Did you know that part of the new CARES Act allows for a $300 above-the-line deduction for charitable giving in 2020, this year? That means you can use this deduction even if you take the standard deduction instead of itemizing.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, it's not huge, but still, imagine the good we can all do if everyone who can afford to give $300 uses their deduction to support charities to aid communities and at-risk individuals during this pandemic.
If you want to talk to someone about the changes from the CARES Act, you can schedule a time to talk to First Move Financial by going to firstmovefinancial.com/familygamers. Thank you to First Move Financial for sponsoring this episode of the Family Gamers Podcast. In fact, if you are in a situation where your life is actually stable, I think you could even probably give some of that money from the stimulus to a charitable organization and use it for the CARES Act.
Take that deduction. Yeah.
Yeah. That seems like it makes sense to me. Awesome. So the reason why we have Jen, the board game librarian, on the show is because, as you know, over the last few weeks, we've been trying to look at things from, I'm going to say, either educational or coping with the reality that your children are distance learning kind of situation. And Jen, you do this like really awesome thing with board games and books.
So my whole shtick on the Dice Tower on Board Game Breakfast for my From the Page to the Table segment is pairing a book and a board game together. Sometimes it's like super obvious, like this past week, I had been sent a comic book, which I would highly recommend for the Family Gamers podcast. Actually, it's called A Flower in a Field of Lions. So it's by Tapestry Comics, and it tells the story and life of Joan of Arc. It's maybe middle school, age appropriate and up, just because there's some war violence that is in there. Language content is fine and everything else is age appropriate. But tells her story starting from her trial and does in flashbacks for rise to power of sorts, if we'll say, to her ultimate sacrifice. And I paired it with Mythic Games' Time of Legends, the Joan of Arc miniatures game. Also, really cool, pretty educational. You could totally take out like the mythic creatures and play just as a straight up battle scenario. But I found it to be very educational as well.
Very cool.
So that's
very
my cool. shtick. It is awesome. Pretty cool. Tapestry Comics, their whole shtick is providing educational and historically accurate graphic novels. So as a educator of sorts, I really appreciate that because there's some really great stuff out there. There's some real garbage out there. And kids are really into comic books these days and graphic novels, which is wonderful. So anytime I can encourage a love of reading and some history, win-win.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, we talked a couple weeks ago about if you can get your kids reading, it literally doesn't matter what it is most of the time, as long as it's age appropriate. They could read comic books, they could read manga stuff, whatever, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I would wholeheartedly agree with that sentiment. We get a lot of parents, very concerned parents, who kind of like side whisper to us, so my child is into graphic novels? And sometimes they have like this look of horror on their face, like they're very firm. I do not want my child reading graphic novels. And then when you talk about the benefits of it, just thinking outside of the box, different linear thinking, you know, the matching emotion and the text and all that together, and especially for English language learners too, they're wonderful learning opportunities. Mm-hmm. So graphic novels are great. And I think you're going to bring one up today on our podcast, correct?
Maybe.
Very likely.
So that's what we're going to talk about this week. So we're obviously going to start with what we've been playing, talk about a couple other things, just kind of life in general. And then we're going to take a break. When we come back from our break, we have a couple of board game and book combinations. Jen has prepared a few board game and book combinations that may or may not have previously existed from the Pages to the Table section of Board Game Breakfast. And that's going to be the show this week. So I'm excited. I think we're going to have a really good time. But we were talking before the show, Jen, for those people who don't know you, you are on the internet, the board game librarian. And I was lurking on Facebook when you were having a conversation with somebody about the difference between a librarian and someone who works in a library. And we decided we would table that conversation for the show. So first, let's talk about what you do as the board game librarian, because people are hearing board game librarian and their ears immediately perk up because that's something they're interested in. I wish I had a board game librarian in my town.
Yeah,
But then let's talk about this whole like working in a library thing.
I know, it does sound like I have the coolest job title ever, right? Like, I'm a librarian and my thing is board games. What? It's crazy. That's probably a smaller chunk of my actual job than it would sound like. My actual title at my work is Head of Reference on Adult Services, which is sadly just so not as exciting as board game librarian. But that encompasses the fact that A, I am a librarian, and B, that I do work with board games at my library. That can be anywhere from running a really cool and awesome program for adults every month. It can run from circulating board games. It can come from collection development and picking out new ones, even just phone calls from other librarians across the country on how to get their own collections or game groups started. And advocacy, of course, as well. Tons and tons of advocacy for why gaming in general in libraries is not just some trend. It's a long-term goal that we should all have. And it's totally cool and totally acceptable to have in your library. You were probably seeing the conversation between Bethany and I, and Bethany from Ryan and Bethany Board Games. They're also on Board Game Breakfast. And Bethany is a library assistant. And we've gotten into a conversation about libraries and librarians. So yes, there is a difference. I kind of liken it to a school. So like in a school, you have your teachers who've likely gone and gotten their master's in teaching. And then you have your paraprofessionals, right, who are working with the teachers, but they don't have that professional degree. So it's the same thing. Most libraries today, if you want to work either at a reference desk or at a children's desk, they require you to have a master's in library science. Your pages, your circulation assistants, your cataloging people, they don't necessarily have professional degrees. Some of them are working on them. Some of them have them and just aren't in a professional position. So it's kind of the same thing. But, you know, I mean, altogether, just like in a school, every cog makes the whole thing work. And without our pages and without our circulation people, we wouldn't work. So, yeah. That's kind of a nutshell.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Just like my kids might say, my teacher so-and-so and my teacher so-and-so. And what they really mean is the teacher and then
the TA aid. Or something. The aide, yeah.
You know, yeah. The fact that when we walk into our local library, we see people behind the desk who are like, oh, the librarian. We can call them that, but maybe that's not really their job description.
Yeah, I guess for me, it just never really occurred to me that library science was something that you could get an advanced degree in. Like,
oh, yeah.
So the thing is, I don't know what goes into that. And so it's so foreign to me that, like, I don't want to minimize the value of it in any way. But, like, I have no idea.
Jeez,
like,
I almost
picture, like, you know those scenes from Sherlock with Benedict Cumberbatch where, like, the numbers are floating in front of him?
Yeah.
I almost feel like a requirement of, like, a master's in library science is that you can do that with, like, the Dewey Decimal System. Like, I don't know what goes into it. And I'm not trying to minimize it at all. I'm not. I have no clue what constitutes a library science degree at all.
Well, so it was a running joke between my husband and I. So I finished my master's like 6 months before my husband went on to get his master's degree. Mm-hmm. And I'd already been working in a library for, by the time I finished, 5 years. And I didn't go to a school that necessarily had a very rigorous master's program. So I did, frankly, a lot of busy work.
Okay.
But sometimes they consist of internships and shadowing. Sometimes they consist of special projects where you're writing like a master's thesis of 50, 60, 70 pages. In particular, I did coursework on cataloging. So when we get items in and we have to put them into our computer system, there's like a whole process and theory. So the Dewey Decimal System is one of those. And then Library of Congress, which most universities use, is like the other system.
Okay.
And they're all very, very, very different and very specific too. It can be on supervising, being a supervisor. And another thing too is like, the things we never learned in library school, like what happens when the toilet overflows, which happens so many more times than you would ever think it does.
I mean, libraries are a public space and you're not going to deny people the ability to use the bathroom. So, no, I'm not surprised at all
how often
that happens.
Or even, you know, that's kind of on the funny end, but like on the sad end, and this is a very true story, what happens when one of your patrons who's sitting at a computer goes down and has a seizure? What do you do? How do you respond to that? You know, and kind of things like that. So it can be very interesting work. It can be very rewarding work, but it can also be like a teacher. There's a lot of burnout as well. Yeah, no, you did not minimize my coursework and my 2 years. Some people have called it like just a union card. The unfortunate fact, at least in Connecticut, I don't know how it is in Massachusetts, to make any kind of money working in a library, you have to have a master's degree. If you don't have a master's degree and you want to find professional work in a library, you're just not going to get paid it. And you might as well go and get the degree.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right. So what we usually do on the show is we talk a little bit about the games that we've been playing. So I'm sure that you're a lot like us in that your available free time has increased.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So what games have you been getting to the table?
Last May, we both finally took the plunge and spent the $3.99 and bought BG Stats, which I don't know if either one of you use BG Stats.
Oh, we do.
Yes.
Oh, we do. Oh,
definitely.
Totally worth the $4. I was being such a cheapo by not buying
same.
It.
Same.
We even bought the like expansion thing for the extra challenges and insights and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. So my husband, Matt, is talking about, he's like, I think we should spend, is it like 99 cents?
Maybe? Yeah, the extra dollar.
Yeah.
Do it.
I'm going, but it's a dollar. And I go, Jen, you're so cheap.
It's so like our sense of economy when it comes to like iPhone and Android apps is so twisted.
Yes.
I can buy a quarter of a coffee, or I could get the advanced stats for BG Stats. Nope. Quarter of a coffee it is.
I'm not spending that dollar. I will not. It's I want everything to be free.
It's like, oh, maybe I'll do it if somebody buys me a gift card. Like, it's so ridiculous.
Because information wants to be free, man.
Okay. Thank you, Cory Doctorow. Like, come on.
I say that jokingly because in a previous life, I was also a computer programmer like Andrew is, and although it's easy to take a program and duplicate it and spread it out all over the world, it still takes someone's time and effort to make that program in the first place.
Yep.
And they deserve to be compensated for it.
Yeah, that's true. That's totally true. So when we downloaded BG Stats, my husband Matt had uploaded all the games in our collection. He was very ambitious. I'm very lazy and I add them as we play them.
Fair.
That's what I do.
Yeah, and you would think as a librarian, I would want to catalog them all right away, but no, that did not happen.
No, it's like the cobbler's shoes thing.
The cobbler's children have no shoes.
Yeah, exactly. True. Like, it's true just that. I don't want to take that work home with me. Like, I stopped playing computer games when I became a computer programmer because I don't want to look at my monitor anymore after the workday is over.
Oh, the screen time lately. Ugh, that too. So we have been trying to work on all of our unplayed games since we downloaded BG Stats. So we've been plucking away at that. We had a very large number that we started with maybe back in December. And we've gotten it down to like 25, maybe, that we haven't played in the year.
Wow.
So this is kind of going off what Jimmy Stegmaier said in a podcast or Facebook or YouTube video sometime last year. The premise is that if you haven't played a game in your collection in a year, why are you keeping it? Which is very interesting. Or, you know, if you have that many games that you haven't played everything at least once, then you have too many games and you need to pare down. And we're probably at the 350, 400 range. I don't know about you guys.
No, we're actually right about in the same place.
And everyone always has limited space. So today this is a really long story. Wow, you're never going to want to have me back. Storytelling is just, whew.
Pits. I mean, I feel like librarian storytelling, it's on brand, so it's okay.
Okay, cool. So we played also on brand Shakespeare today. Very on brand. Kind of an action selection. If you haven't played it before, you're using characters from his plays. You're using Shakespeare himself. You're looking to write three acts in a play. You're looking to decorate your stage. You're looking to put costumes on your actors and actresses and have the most points. Pretty cool. It's got this really cool mechanism of filling in the stage, which I like. And it's book themed. So nerd. Gotta love nerds. What about both of you?
Well, we have built-in gamers, but they're younger. So we don't tend to play the more complex stuff. I suppose we could. We just focus on two-player stuff when we play two-player, as opposed to like a 2-4 kind of thing. We did play some Skull Hollow. I don't remember if we talked about that on the last show.
We did.
I love that game.
But it's really good.
It's so good. And then I haven't played that much because of work being stressful. But today we pulled out a new game from Game Right. It's coming out this year. Maybe it has just come out. I don't know. Called Marshmallow Test.
It's great. I mean, the concept is the famous marshmallow test, the test of can a little kid hold out for a couple of minutes, you know, and not eat the marshmallow in front of them for the promise of more marshmallows later. It's a trick-taking game by Reiner Knizia. So it's a really simple trick-taking game. It's five suits and all your normal trick-taking rules apply. So somebody declares trump at the beginning of a round. It stays the same. You play the same color as was played at the beginning of the trick, unless you can't. Really, really basic stuff. However,
as soon as a player hits a certain number of tricks that they've won, we played with four players, so it was three tricks.
Yep.
That person is immediately out of the round. They get points based on how many tricks everybody else has won. And then the round continues until there are only two people left. And then one of those two people gets three tricks. They go out, they get a lot of points, and the other person gets nothing.
So it's a pretty basic, typical trick-taking game. It's very simple. Our yes. nine-year-old picked it up immediately. Our five-year-old was okay.
He was okay. Then, he didn't quite have the attention span to hold out for the whole game, but that's he definitely fine. Understood how
not it works. Only is he five, but he's classic boy five.
Yeah.
Like if when our nine-year-old was five, he could have played this game.
Yes.
But it does. It's got that concept of delayed gratification where you want to get as close to the end as possible, but you don't want to be the last one because if you're the last one, you get no points. When we got to the end of the game, it was just me and our nine-year-old left and we both had 14 points and we knew that whoever went out was going to get, I think, 7 points and then win the game. And the other person was going to immediately lose. And so I had two cards left in my hand and neither one of them was the Trump suit. And he played a Trump card and I was like, And so, so he just won. But that was Marshmallow Test. And it comes with, okay, so the scoring tokens are either big or small, squishy marshmallows. They're squishy. They're squishy.
Oh, so, I do love a good trick taking game. Is it three to five players?
It's 2 to 5 players, actually. So you could actually play. Yeah, I don't know how 2-player works. It says ages 10 plus. You can totally go below that.
Yeah.
And it's game right. So it's like a $15 game. They have somebody with a magic wand in their production department. Every game they make is cheaper than I expect it to be. So, yeah, it's $15. It's on Amazon right now. I mean, it's not going to blow you away. It's not this grand inventive new thing, but it's solid.
Yeah.
So that's Marshmallow Test from Game Rate.
I just Googled it and found it. It looks adorable. With, again, squishy little marshmallows.
Squishy marshmallows. Mm-hmm. They're definitely the best part of the game.
Yep. Oh. I shared a picture of us playing it, a composite picture of us playing it on Facebook today, so you can see the squishy marshmallows.
Very cute. And a trick-taking game that plays it too, I feel like, is a rare bird.
Yeah, so, I don't know how that works, and we're going to have to look that up.
We will definitely be figuring that out over the next couple of weeks.
Maybe when it's just the two of us trying to find a game to play.
Maybe.
Makes sense. What do you got?
You, me, and our two older kids finally beat game two of Hogwarts Battle.
We did.
Finally.
Oh.
It's taken us so many tries, and everybody's like, oh, you know, it doesn't get hard until, like, book four, and I'm like, we've played book two 4 times.
Have you played Harry Potter Hogwarts Battle?
So we went through all 7 books. There were a couple that we had to do a couple of times, so don't feel so bad.
I'm wondering if it's harder at higher player counts.
We always wonder that too with cooperative games. And then we added the Box of Monsters. We thought, oh, this wasn't so bad. And it went from like being not so bad to ridiculously hard and almost unplayable because it was so hard. We ended up selling both. Yeah, we ended up selling both the base game and the expansion.
Wow.
Yeah, because it went from like a 3 comfortability to a 13. but yeah, we've played through it. Are the kids enjoying playing it?
I think so.
Yeah.
Asher, our 9-year-old, has not read the books or anything. I'm reading the books to our 11-year-old. I had never read them before, so I'm reading them for the first time to her who's hearing them for the first time. We're in Deathly Hallows now, so we're pretty far ahead of where we are in the game.
Yes.
But I think they're having fun. I mean, I think at this point, Harry Potter is in culture enough that nothing that our 9-year-old is seeing is like surprising. It's like, oh, it's Voldemort and it's Harry and Ron and blah, 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 blah. Like, whatever. Mm. So the op did announce a new expansion this year for the game that allows for a 5th player. It's the Charms and Potions expansion. So Ginny Weasley goes from an ally to an actual playable character.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm. So there's that. But yeah, I feel really dumb when we play this game sometimes because I know people have played through them all and they're like, oh yeah, you know, we played through the game and maybe it was okay, whatever. Look, any deck builder, you can lose simply because the wrong cards come out. It has nothing to do with your ability to play the game.
I think that's happened.
A couple of losses are expected. But like, we're playing this thing over and over again and we're like, why is this so hard? And it's like, okay, I can't. Can I just can I take the Olohomoras out of my deck, please? I don't need them anymore. But anyway, so yeah, so that was that. And I like playing that game because we get 4 of us playing and our 5-year-old is just running around like a maniac because that's what he does anyway. So yeah, so that's that. Game 3 will come next. And then game 4 is a big box.
Yeah,
well, I think it has dice in it or something.
You know what? We're not anywhere near playing game 4 yet. On a more educational note, our kids
in the last couple of days have started pulling out Bananagrams and playing it.
Yeah, I don't know how or why, but I'm good for it.
It just happens sometimes, and I'm going to slightly revise my earlier opinion that I was like, hey, I like this. It feels kind of like a Scrabble or a Boggle, but it's in some ways less competitive because you're only working on your own grid. You don't really care about what other people are doing, except in terms of speed. I'm going to revise that a little bit because we played with our five-year-old, the Agent of Chaos, who is just barely starting to read. So he will not be denied. He's like, I can make words. Let me play the game.
I can't tell you how many times today. I don't know what I was. I was like making breakfast or something. And all I could hear was, Elliot, that's not a word. Yes, it is. What's the word? It's a word.
10 million
so
points.
Many times. I've decided that when he plays Bananagrams, really all that's doing is it is a source of pulling away letters from everybody else that means we're not going to have them available and be able to use them. It's certainly made for interesting games. However, I will say the older two kids have both progressed now from simply like making words or latching onto like, I have four letters I need for this like 6 or 7 letter word that I really want to make. I'm just going to keep pulling more from the pile until I can make this one big word, to starting to understand the strategy of I need to make words that interlock and try to actually use up all my letters. So it's been interesting to watch. And I think a game like that is a good addition for your older kids. Yes, reading is good. Yes, writing is good. But let's do some of that in a little bit more gamey format. Work through some of the vocabulary you have in your head and identifying how to put the letters together to make different kinds of words. I mean, it's right there in the word. It's Bananagrams, but it's really a game of anagrams. So oh, cool. That's been fun.
I think the only other thing we've been playing was Superpowered Smash Masters. It's going to be the Snap review coming up this coming weekend.
Yes.
It's this ridiculous game with
non-copyrighted
powered
superheroes
just beating the pants off of each other.
Yeah,
that's it.
That's really all it is.
It's a game from Dark Unicorn Games. One of the heroes is Dark Unicorn, and he has a sidekick named Night Pony. And I just think that's great that Night Pony comes out and starts kicking everybody. It's ridiculous. Imagine something like Mystery Men, only they actually have superpowers, and that's this game.
Pretty much. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a very simple game.
Yeah, zero strategy to this game. There's no strategy. Come on. There's no strategy to this game. You just punch.
I got one more.
Okay.
Another oldie but goodie. Mm-hmm. Our kids pulled out Tournament of Towers, and we played that several times today, actually. Tournament of Towers is a dexterity game that also includes card drafting. You have a hand of cards, you're drafting them around, and your ending hand of cards or ending set of cards are the 5 or 6 or 7 pieces that you're going to use to then try to build the best tower. And this game is great because they've explicitly made it so, first of all, there's two categories of pieces. There's these gray, very structural pieces, and then these goldish yellow pieces, which are incredibly hard to build with. But even the gray pieces come in lots of different sizes and shapes and contours, so that it's really challenging to kind of get your mind around, how am I going to build a tall tower with this? How is it going to be stable? How can I get it all to stay together? And the pieces are really well designed, that some do fit together just right. It's really cool. It's a much harder game than it looks like at first. But once you kind of wrap your mind around like, oh, I might fail at putting this tower together, because this isn't like a Jenga. This isn't everything is the same shape and size. Once you get your mind wrapped around that, then you can really start to have fun with it and say, well, what if I try this? What if I try this? Shall I go for lots of these yellow gold pieces that are super hard to use, but get me lots of points? I don't know. So I'm having fun with that.
I went on BoardGameGeek and I'm browsing through the pictures for Tournament of Towers. And there is a guy who has legit pulled out a measuring tape and has it measuring how tall his tower is.
Yeah.
So it looked pretty hardcore and pretty wild, too. Like, this game just looked wild. I love it.
I mean, our game, in which we did less than the recommended number of cards, therefore pieces, per round, because we're making it easier for the kids. Our game still, most of the time, we had final towers that neared a foot high. with any individual piece isn't more than about 2 inches, and you can't just stack them all one on top of the other. So yeah, in a regular full game, I would expect there to be multiple players with towers that reach close to 2 feet. It's kind of crazy.
I mean, this is the formalized version of stacking up a bunch of junk in your room and seeing what you can do, because it's so weird. Like, the pieces are so weird, and even though they're designed to go together by nature of the fact that they're all in the same game, like, they're clearly not really designed to go together, that it literally feels like you're just piling up a bunch of junk.
Yeah.
But it's got scaffolding around it. It turns it into a real game, and it's genuinely entertaining, even for adults.
I'd love a good stacking game.
Yeah, I don't know if this would be a good one to play in the library, though. It's kind of loud.
Even better.
Well, I know.
What?
As a warning to our listeners, this game is great. If you look at the sticker price on it, you will probably go into shock. It's because it is really, really heavy.
Mm-hmm.
This is a heavy game.
Yeah, they're not messing around with these pieces.
Classic pieces.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Those are like 2 new games you guys talked about that I had never heard of before. So that's pretty exciting.
Got probably a lot more that you've never heard of before.
Well, now you have.
Yeah, now you have. All right.
Excellent.
Have you been playing anything else lately?
We played Parks today. Have you guys talked about Parks on the podcast yet?
We played it back in February, I guess. I want to own that game. It is beautiful and really, really just nice. You know, sometimes you use something like an Apple product or a Sonos product, and you're like, this is just nice. Like, everything about it is nice.
Just feels better than similar things.
Just nice. Yeah, that's how I feel about Parks.
Yeah, I agree. And I feel like it's a very pleasant experience, too. Like, you know, you're competing against each other, but it's, you know, you're journeying to these national parks and you're collecting these really cool bits, and it's all just colorful and just, you know, nature, and I love it.
Very Tocado like.
Yeah,
I've never played Tocado before.
Oh, you should. Oh, it's a wonderful game.
Recently, yeah. You could get it on iOS and Android for free. I don't know if you still can.
Yeah, I don't know if you can either.
But
free.
I know, we already talked about this. But the iOS/Android implementation is really good. Like, it's nice. Sometimes you play these games and it's like, oh, they just kind of slapped, you know, the artwork on some kind of engine thing. Like, no, they full on developed a whole game of Tokaido with 3D rendering and everything. It's nice.
Wow. That's very impressive.
So anyway, yeah. So Parks. I'm with you on Parks.
Parks. And Dungeon Academy. Have you heard about that one?
Yes.
OP? Yes.
That game is great.
It is great. Again, I like the real-time aspect of it, for sure.
Yeah, me too.
Sometimes with those, I can get real, like, anxious and... But the game is so short that I feel like, who cares, you know, with the real-time aspect. It's super cute. Great for families, too. I don't know if you played it with the kids.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, a nice little kind of small box game.
Yeah, I'm not a huge roll-and-write/flip-and-write person. It just hasn't... It's not really a style of game that I love.
Are you a big, like, real-time game fan?
I'm okay with real-time stuff. But Dungeon Academy was the first roll-and-write/flip-and-write game that I pulled out the laminator for.
Ooh, fancy.
Yeah, I know.
And then
we brought it to a friend's house and we played it with some dry erase markers, and they told us wet erase markers are actually better to write on lamination because it won't rub off.
We can confirm that now.
So we went and bought some wet erase markers. Also, wet erase markers are easier to find fine tip, which is important for board gaming. So pro tip for anyone out there, if you laminate stuff so you don't have to buy new pads or whatever, wet erase markers are the way to go.
Yeah, sometimes they're sold as overhead markers.
Mm-hmm. Yep, same thing. Yeah, with wetness, they wipe off cleaner than dry erase markers do, and they don't smudge when you touch them because they're wet erase. So pretty much universally just better.
Yes.
Oh, so big fan of Dungeon Academy.
Excellent. Those are kind of some different things that we've been playing.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right, well, why don't we do this? Why don't we take a break? And then when we come back, we're going to start talking about books and board games.
Let's do that.
All right, we'll be right back.
Giant forest troll blocks your path. A spell might trick the troll into letting you pass, or you can give up your clanky armor to sneak by.
Yes, indeed, you are my squire. I am a famous adventurer. When I complete quests, I earn loot, and you get to carry it. You choose what items will be the most valuable to me?
and you choose which ones I can afford to give up. You better arrange my bag efficiently for extra points, and don't fill it up with too much junk.
This is a snap review for Squire for Hire, an 18-card game for one or two players, designed by John Merchant and published by Letterman Games.
This is perhaps the most interesting bag-building game I think we've ever played.
So bag-building is the theme rather than the mechanic for this game. It's actually an inventory management game where you are one of four apprentices or squires, and you are storing loot for your master.
So Asher, how does a game of Squire for Hire work?
So first you're going to get a random squire. There's four different ones. There's Gust, the knight squire, Tenderfoot, the thief's pupil, Uru, a mage's apprentice, and Fran, a paladin's trainee.
And so these different squires have different abilities where different pieces of junk actually become valuable, or different kinds of items that you get become even more valuable at the end of the game, right?
Yeah.
So Anitra, how does the game actually work?
You start with one card representing your bag of tools and loot that you start with. In the middle of the table is a story card. This can be a quest, a dungeon, or an encounter, and two cards that show more inventory that you could acquire. You complete quests and encounters by covering up some of the loot currently on your card with a different card from the two currently available.
You complete the quest that's face up by paying the penalty on that quest. Sometimes this is just a threshold. You have to have a certain number of something. Sometimes it is something where you actually have to cover those things up to subtract them from what you have in your bag. When you complete that quest, you get to pick up one of those two cards that shows more things that could be in your bag. What do you do with it?
Any new card you place, you have to put at least one item from that card so that it would be completely contained in your previous card area. That's your previous bag. If you cover up any items from your previous bag, you have to cover them completely. No covering two squares of a three square item.
And that is how you build your bag. So how does the game end?
The game ends when you run out of cards in the deck. For scoring, first you get 1 point for every good item that is not junk, and minus 1 point for every junk. For every item that you have two of the same of touching each other, then you score an extra 1 point for those two touching. Your squire also has a special ability where sometimes it will make some junk worth points, or maybe just no negative points at all. Or sometimes it'll make junk worth points and other junk worth more negative points.
I think you also get a bonus sometimes on some of that good stuff, where if you have certain pieces of good stuff that are touching, you get extra on top of that plus one.
For example, Tenderfoot the Thief's Pupil gets an extra point if you have coins touching a gold ring, and an extra 2 points if you have coins touching a treasure chest.
In a two-player game, both players count up their scores and whoever has the highest score wins.
If you're playing a solo game, you'll win if you score at least 25 points. You've passed your apprenticeship, you no longer have to be a squire.
Now you can get items for yourself.
And make someone else carry them for you.
That's right.
So, let's talk about what we think about Squire for Hire.
I've talked a lot about Squire for Hire on the Family Gamers podcast and how much I like it as a date game. This is a 18-card game that fits in a nice little folded-up bag-like pouch that has all the rules printed on it. It's nice and compact. It can fit in a pocket. You can take it anywhere, and it doesn't take that much room on the table.
I really love that this neat little folded case has all the rules so that there aren't any extra pieces you have to keep track of anywhere.
And I like the art.
The art is relatively simple and straightforward, but it's very, very good for what it is. Each different type of item, weapons, armor, magic, valuables like gold, and then potions, each have their own color outline, which helps them stand out on the inventory cards. It's very clear what everything is and exactly where it fits in the 12-square grid on each card.
Squire for Hire doesn't require a lot of reading. The quests obviously are written down, but honestly, you can get by just understanding the iconography. So this is definitely a game that you could play with a younger player, especially if you have one reader who could read the quest to anyone who's playing.
Agreed. Although the Squire's special powers, I generally find myself referring back to over and over again. So those are more helpful if you can read them.
So Asher, what do you think we should rate Squire for Hire from Letterman Games?
I think we should rate it 4 Squires out of 5.
And that's Squire for Hire
in a snap.
And we're back. Let's talk about board games that pair well with books, or books that pair well with board games.
Mm-hmm. This is your thing, Jen. So we will yield to the master on this.
Oh, no, I want to. So in the interim, we were talking about one that you had come up with.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you want me to start with that one? Okay,
I do, right. Yeah.
Okay.
My interest has peaked.
Yeah, so we have a game that we talk about a lot. We bring it with us a lot of places because it's relatively small. And that game is Deep Sea Adventure. Have you played Deep Sea Adventure by Oink Games? Yeah. So I was looking at our game shelf and thinking about Deep Sea Adventure. And of course, the classic Deep Sea Adventure is 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Excellent. I love it.
I mean, there's not really a lot of narrative plot to Deep Sea Adventure.
But that's okay.
But, you know, you're diving in the ocean, and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea is kind of about diving in the ocean. And I felt like that made a good pairing. I'm not as good at this as you are, so I don't know what else I'm supposed to say. But so for the conceptual purposes of this show, Deep Sea Adventure is a game that you can play with your kids, and you can talk about like what scuba divers do, and you could talk about this classic book that talks all about these adventures under the ocean and assign them some reading, some friendly classics reading.
20,000 Leagues is one of those books where I've read it before, and I think I had paired it with Nemo's War last year or the year before. And 20,000 Leagues is one of those books where you either love it or hate it.
That's a school
book. For some people,
like that's
yeah.
Like Gulliver's Travels. You either love it or you hate it.
Well, yeah. There's also this to be said for it that Jules Verne was basically the first science fiction writer.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, 20,000 Leagues and Journey to the Center of the Earth, even Around the World in 80 Days, are all what we would now recognize as science fiction, either alternate history or exploring things that can't be done, but maybe can be done someday.
Yeah, he was pretty cool. And I feel like an illustrated classic version of 20,000 Leagues would be much more exciting than the adult version.
Yes, I agree.
So tailor these pairings to your own children.
Absolutely. Oh, geez.
Or and even a graphic novel.
What? Yes. Oh, I love that even more. So I'm of a certain age as a child of the 90s to remember a show on PBS called Wishbone.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. All right.
Absolutely. Oh,
now we're talking. And Wishbone, I mean, had the novelizations of these classics, too.
We have one on the kids' bookshelf right now that's called Be a Wolf, which is about Beowulf.
Ah. So, hey, even throw, like, the Wishbones at the kids for these. They're reading the classics.
Yeah.
It's excellent. Yes, I've never actually played Deep Sea Adventure before. We have it at work, and I don't know why we haven't played it.
Quick, easy game. It scales to like 8 players or six players or something like that. It's a completely different game at like 2 and 3 players versus 6 players, but it's really good and you can play it on almost any surface. So highly recommend that game. You should try it out.
Yeah. And the portability of all their games is just spot on. I do appreciate that. And one of my picks is a cheat. It's a total cheat. I have not done a review for this yet, and the purpose was for Board Game Breakfast, and it is one of Van Ryder Games's graphic novel adventures.
Woo!
Ah, all right. That works for me.
So we have both a book and a game, not a board game traditionally, but definitely a game. So the one I picked was, and the one that I have is the Sherlock Holmes for Investigations. I think these are so fun. I don't know. Have you guys played any of them?
Yes, I have gone through that book with our daughter, and she had enough foresight to do all the, there's not a lot of writing, but there's a couple places where they're like, tally this stuff in the book. She's like, no, I refuse, and did it all in a separate notebook so that then she could turn around and do it again with her little brother.
Oh, That's super cute, though.
Our 11-year-old has become shockingly conscientious in a lot of ways about how to do stuff with her youngest brother. It's really cute.
That is cute. But I agree. I'm a note taker over here. And again, being a child of a certain age where, you know, we all had the Choose Your Own Adventure books. And they recently re-released them in the last couple of years with different covers. So I feel like even your children, too, are like of a great age to be doing those. These books are like timeless and it doesn't matter what age you are. But I have like, you know, my scribbled notes here in front of me. I haven't even finished this book. I've done maybe two of the four investigations. And in terms of replayability, I feel like I've let enough time go by in between the investigations that I go back and I redo the investigations and I'm not losing anything. For everyone who's concerned about that, it's fine. And I do feel like I picked Watson. You have an option to pick either Sherlock or Watson.
Yep.
And I picked Watson because he's the cool one.
He's the one I actually wouldn't mind having over to dinner.
Yes, agreed. Yeah. I feel like that was a Sherlock burn.
I admire him a lot from afar. Yes. I wouldn't want him in my house.
Absolutely. I mean, this is ages 14 and up, but I mean, your daughter's a lot. 11, right? You said?
Yeah.
So, I mean, even an 8-year-old, I think, would have a good time with this. And it's something, too, that's like great for if you're on a long car ride or if you're going to be on a plane a long time, where you could just sit and hunker down and do the whole book and then maybe pass it on to the next person. I've had a fun time with it. I think the illustrations were great, easy to understand. Yeah, lots of fun. So, that is my cheaty pick.
So around the same time that I found this, I also found a 4-book set they did called The Crusoe Crew. Do you know about this?
I do, yeah.
So this is the same adventure, but with 4 different people, and you can split up. It's basically almost like cooperative reading. Each person can have their own book, and they can kind of split up and then come back together. And it's the same adventure in all 4 books from different perspectives, and it's really cool. And the reason why I mention it is because Van Ryder is doing the same thing, the 4-part thing, in a Sherlock Holmes universe / world.
Oh.
And so that should be coming like later this year.
Oh,
I talked
very cool.
to the people at Van Ryder at Unplugged, and they said that it should be coming sometime in 2020. So that'll be really neat.
Yeah,
that is exciting. It seems like they've had a lot of good success with the series. Very cool. So what else did you folks pick?
Well, if we're going to talk Sherlock, I also selected a Sherlock pairing, and that is the game Beyond Baker Street. Have you played Beyond Baker Street?
I have, but I don't think we played a full game of it. It was with friends of ours, and I think we had to stop for some reason. It's like Hanabi, but not Hanabi.
Yeah, Beyond Baker Street for us, Anitra's laughing because I've said this a million times, completely replaces Hanabi in our house. It's got the same hidden information, not hidden information mechanic, clue information mechanic. I don't know what you would describe it as, where you're holding your cards away from you and you need to have other players cooperate with you to get the information in your hand so that you can play down certain cards to catch the villains. And basically, it's the generic Hanabi mechanic with an actual plot wrapped around it, which is based in the Sherlock Holmes universe. And I really like it. So I think those Sherlock mysteries are small enough that you could say, read this today, or read this over the course of 2 days, and then we'll play this game.
Maybe.
Eh.
They're short, but the language is challenging.
So, I mean, that's going to be for an older child, I think.
Yeah,
but I
even
also
then,
think
the language might be challenging.
I also think the mechanics of Beyond Baker Street are such that you're going to be playing that with an older child anyway.
Sure.
So it is going to require more advanced reading, but I do think it's a good pairing of those games. So there you go. So we've got the Sherlock novelization, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's stories. And then for the younger kids, we've got the Choose Your Own Adventure. And for the older kids, we've got Beyond Baker Street.
Look at you.
So there we go. Time. Come on. All right.
Whew. All ages. I love it. That's a relief. Yeah, I totally agree with Anitra, though, that the writing style and language, I think it can be even challenging for adults to get through. So those are maybe better on audiobook for some readers, or again, those illustrated classics.
Or graphic novels, once again.
Yes.
This is one where I will even say, I mean, you know your kids, but if you can find the old Masterpiece mystery series of Sherlock Holmes that was on television 20-something years ago now,
those are a great way to introduce how much emotion and tension there is in those mysteries. Because sometimes as a kid, if you're trying to read through that, you get so bogged down in the language that you miss what's actually going on.
Yeah, I agree. They're entertaining for sure. But you do have to kind of slough through some of that other stuff to get really to the heart of the book.
I mean, I was a nerdy kid with really nerdy parents, so I would beg to stay up and watch mystery on PBS sometimes. And so I watched a bunch of that Sherlock TV series before I ever tried reading the books. And then I kind of knew what I was looking for in the books and I was able to make better headway.
Very cool. So I picked one for our teenage and adult audience. So the game was my favorite from 2018. They are working on an expansion for it. And so the book series is from Brandon Sanderson. And the first one is Steelheart. And the game is The Reckoners. So the idea is that this big cataclysm has happened, and instead of our superheroes being the good guys, they are the bad guys. We have this one kind of Superman-esque superhero, supervillain, really, called Steelheart, and he has deeply impacted our main character's life, completely changed it, turned it on its head. And he assembles this team of humans, or what he thinks are all humans, to help him take down Steelheart. Brandon Sanderson, I feel like, is a master of anything that he puts his pen on. The man, he pops a book out, like, so quickly, and they're all Big Mama books, too. And they're clunkers, door stoppers.
Most of them, yeah. Except for his YA.
Yes, except for his YA. Yeah. And he has another series, I believe it's him, with the evil librarians and Alcatraz.
Yes, Alcatraz versus the evil librarians. My kids are working their way through that series right now.
Excellent.
It's really funny.
They might be a little young, your kids, for the Reckoners series, maybe when they're 13, because there is some romance and love interest that goes on. Nothing too scintillating. But totally love the series, and I think it's readable for adults as well. It's not one of those YA series where it's a little immature. It's something that, as an adult reader, I enjoyed, and I don't normally read young adult. That's not part of my wheelhouse. But The Reckoners, cooperative game, you are playing as one of the six people on the team, and you are trying to take down Steelheart. First of all, the production from Nauvoo Games on this is through the roof. It's just fantastic. It's got game trays, the specialty dice, metal bits. They, again, knocked it out of the park on this one. But it's one of those cooperative games where it really forces you to listen and interact with each other. And being an alpha gamer on this one, you're going to lose. You're going to lose very quickly. The main mechanic is really a Yahtzee-style dice rolling. It's pretty easy. Not easy to win, but I like it a lot. I love that game. Love The Reckoners. But it's also another one of those absurdly big Kickstarter boxes that when you get it in the house, you go, where am I going to put this on the shelf?
Yeah.
The answer is you can afford to knock one divider out of your Kallax.
Yes.
That's the answer. For those four or five games that are too big.
Yeah. I had this conversation with my husband today. I said, you know, I'm getting really sick of these oversized boxes. I don't know how you feel about this.
Yeah. But I remember when we got Hogwarts Battle in the house, I was like, man, this box is way bigger than I expected it to be. I mean, it's not one of the really huge ones, but it was a lot bigger than I thought.
Yeah. And so it goes.
And so it goes.
On the flip side, Tournament of Towers, which I mentioned earlier, just barely fits all the pieces in the box.
Yeah, we've got a couple of games like that, like Campaign Trail. We bought the deluxe version of Campaign Trail, and that's a game that it takes me three or four times to get, there's no divider. It's just to get everything in the box.
Yeah.
So I feel you.
Yeah, and we don't have Kallax shelves. We went with a different IKEA, more like bookcase style, where you could adjust the shelves differently. But even so, yeah. Ugh, these big boxes.
Yeah,
I like big boxes.
No, you don't like big boxes. That's
you like weird. Games that come in big boxes.
Yes. I do like games that come in big boxes. That really is the problem right there.
And you cannot lie.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, we have one more game on our list, and this is the game that you alluded to earlier.
So, well, in this case, the game and the book go by the same name. It is the Tea Dragon Society. And officially, it's, I guess, the Tea Dragon Society card game.
Have you seen this adorable little thing?
Yeah. I've seen the adorable artwork and haven't gotten to play or read the graphic novel yet, but I would love to learn more. So please. Woo!
Well, so this is one where, unlike some of these other games we've mentioned, you could play the Tea Dragon Society card game and know nothing about the book and still have a great time with it because the dragons are adorable. And all you really need to know for the game is that you're taking care of these little dragons. And it's a basic deck building game.
It is the most basic of deck builder. Like, yeah. Hogwarts Battle is a basic deck builder. This is a step beneath that. So this is basically, if your children can read, this is the game.
Yeah.
It is a great introduction to deck building. Mm-hmm. Especially because it's literally just, I want to do the best job taking care of my baby dragon.
Aww.
Like, it's just adorable. Mm-hmm. The book, or I should say graphic novel, is about a girl who discovers tea dragons and then finds that there's this society of people who takes care of them. And the society is down to two rather old men. And so they kind of induct her and teach her how to take care of the dragons. And there's a bunch of flashbacks. So you find out more about the backstory of the two older men. And there's a fourth character who gets introduced who's also kind of learning to take care of the dragons. It's pretty simple. It's another kind of book that is pretty decent for a young age range. And with the game, it makes an even better pairing because now you've seen the book and now you can step into the world of the book. And with the game, you can go back and see, oh, well, I understand why this dragon is more touchy if I have this one in my hand versus this dragon is very easygoing. It matches up really, really well.
The artwork is adorable, though.
It's so cute.
It is really cute. And who doesn't want to take care of little baby dragons? I mean, come on.
It's like the board game version of Tamagotchi or something. I don't know.
I mean, kind of.
How's that for a throwback?
I don't think Tamagotchi ever pretended to bite you.
I suppose.
The dragons definitely do.
But they're love bites. They're being
gentle fish.
Cute. Yeah, and what I love about your recommendations that you've given is that they're all affordable, too.
Oh, yeah, we like cheap games.
Very affordable games.
I'll be blunt. The cheaper the game, the better. I'm on board with it. I mean,
well,
it's one of the things, like, I don't want to say that GameRight makes cheap games, because they don't.
No,
but their games are inexpensive, and it's one of the reasons why I love them as a company. Because they have games for every age level, for basically every difficulty level. And I think the most expensive game I have ever seen from them is $30.
Well, and on a very practical level, if you are going to play games with your kids, you're going to feel a lot less protective of a game that only cost you $15 or $20.
Like, this is true.
Yes, I still don't want you to bend the cards or spill on them. But you know what? If you do, we can roll with it. Versus these $60 games, I'm like, five-year-old, please just don't touch.
My five-year-old is never touching my copy of Role Player. It's not going to happen.
Until he's much older.
Until he's older.
Understands how to not destroy things.
Once he can play it, I'm going to need players. So he'll be
he will happily play it with you, I'm sure.
He will.
Oh, no, I hear you, though. Yes, yeah, so you feel a little less anxiety when it's a $15 game than a $60, $80, $90, $100 game. My final pick is one that I'm doing for Board Game Breakfast this week. So I feel like everyone who's either looked on my Instagram or friends with me on Facebook or watches Board Game Breakfast knows that I'm a crazy cat lady.
I'm here for the crazy cat lady content.
Yes. So, I mean, my cats will do drive-bys on video. There's tails, you know. There was one video that I did for breakfast where, like, it was just a cat rear in my face the whole time. And
awesome.
I mean, we all know you can't tell cats what to do. So the game is Cat Lady. I love Cat Lady so much. What I love about Cat Lady in particular, and then I'll talk about the book, is that I feel like it appeals to a lot of non-traditional gamers. And what I mean by that is, be quite blunt with this, not men. Because it's kind of girly looking. It's got like pink, you know, it very much is feeding into that stereotype of sorts. And whether you believe in that stereotype or not, I guess is up for debate. But it's kind of girly. It's real cutesy. So to me, it seems like a game that a lot more women would pick up, which is great. I love that.
Well, and the whole purpose like we need to attract the most cats, right?
Yes. Is it a revolutionary game? No. Do I ooh and ah over every single cat that comes up? Just like, you know, the dragon game. I'm sure you guys do this too with every cute little dragon that comes up. Every cute little cat. I'm like, oh, that cat needs a costume. Which is not something I have not said in real life, okay?
Very few cats need costumes in real life.
They don't want them anyway. But the book I put with it was, and this, again, is feeding into a stereotype, was Dewey, the small town cat, library cat that changed the world.
Oh, that's such a good book.
We heard that on audiobook, I think, going to PAX Unplugged last year?
Might have been going to PAX Unplugged.
But yeah, we just heard this story in the last year. Very adorable and kind of unbelievable. I mean, not that I think it's not real, but like, it was unbelievable.
Yeah, and I think age appropriate for any age. And just the cover, this adorable little cat on the cover. And
little orange puffball.
Your little puffball. And I just love like the animal memoir books. Of course, you have to have a box of tissues ready. Never fails because something heartwarming is going to happen or something very tragic is going to happen. But I just remember reading that book and just loving it so much and thinking, well, gosh, I want a library cat myself. And I feel like the library cat can only happen in very rare instances where it's a very, very, very small town library.
Yes.
Yeah. But it would be cool to have a library cat.
It would be cool, especially if that library cat was like Dewey, as long as you didn't need all of the rubber bands.
Oh, geez. Oh, well, I have one of those in my own house. So
same.
I'm cool. Oh,
yeah.
So, yes, Cat Lady is wonderful. I love Cat Lady. And I absolutely upgraded to the premium edition, even though we had the regular edition. My husband said to me, you're going to make me buy the premium edition when we have the regular one. And I said yes, because the actual bits are the chicken and the milk and the
that's my goodness,
that's funny.
Yes.
Have you seen Catlantis from Ravensburger?
Okay, so Catlantis to me has the best cover on a board game I have ever seen in my entire life.
It's pretty outstanding. So you have seen this game?
Oh, we own it. And so we showed friends of ours who are mostly heavy gamers. They're 18XX. They're Steam. They're super into the train stuff. So we showed it to friends of ours. And the boyfriend was like, I think this is the worst game I've ever played. And I was like,
But the cats.
And the foil. And the tails. Yes. So you've played Catlantis as well?
I have seen Catlantis in multiple shows, but I have not played Catlantis. I've kind of flipped through it. It looks very amazing. That's what I'm going to say.
It's fabulous. That's all I have to say.
Yep.
It's a particular audience that's going to love this. And if you love it, you got to embrace it. So it's staying in our collection.
I understand.
All right.
Anyway. I do feel like cat games are going to be the new thing. With Isle of Cats.
I feel like the guy who did Isle of Cats was definitely onto a good thing of like, hey, I love cats. I would like a cat themed game that is not a 20
like a
minute
game.
Super light goofy game.
Yeah, it's like a cat game that's deep.
Yeah.
Yes. Have you played Isle of Cats yet?
I watched a demo when I went to Origins, but I did not have the hour plus to invest in playing it at that point.
Yeah. And what's nice about Isle of Cats is, and we didn't play it on this mode, is that there's a family mode where it's not as competitive and it's a little easier for younger children to play. But Isle of Cats, I feel like, is where it's at. To me, I feel like it might be my game of the year. I feel like the hype is real on Isle of Cats.
That's a game that I just want to play before thinking about whether or not I'm going to pick it up.
I mean,
that's where I'm at on that game.
That's fair. Knowing that there's a family mode and knowing how much Jen likes it, I'm going to lean slightly more towards seriously considering it now because, I mean, we are a family with cats and our kids all love our cats.
Mm-hmm.
So a cat theme is probably going to go over pretty well.
Maybe we can find someone who's got it and borrow it or something like that and get a play in and then see what we can do from there. So
yeah, it was
good to hear about that family mode, though.
It was definitely on the more expensive side. You get a lot in there. But my husband likened it to Terraforming Mars and Patchwork. That's what he called it. He called it a Terraforming Mars Patchwork mashup.
That is difficult for me to imagine.
Yeah, because there's this, you start each round with drafting cards. So it has that moment. And then the Patrick part of the polynomial, putting it, all the saved cats on your boat.
Sure.
So yeah, I was pleasantly surprised by how much I loved this. Although my husband was like, Jen, it has cats on it. Duh.
You're going to like it.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, I think it even might go up to 5. It might go up to 5 with an expansion. But for what it's worth, very cute.
Sweet.
Fair enough.
All right, well, Jen, you clearly know everything about books. So
this is accurate. I endorse this comment.
That's in the, it's in your annual review. Jen knows everything about books and also board games. There it is. But if people have questions or if people really like this idea and they want to find out more, where can they find you on the internet?
On the webs. Instagram, I say, is my jam. You can find me boardgame.librarian. I also dabble on Twitter at BoardGameLibra1. I should change that someday. It's real bad. And I'm on the Dice Towers Board Game Breakfast almost every week with my segment From the Page to the Table. Cool. Thanks for having me on. This was a blast.
Absolutely. Yes. Anitra, where can people find us, the Family Gamers, online?
Well, you can find us on most social media at Family Gamers AA. That's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram.
Mm-hmm. If you want to head over to our Facebook community, the easiest way to get there is to go to thefamilygamers.com/community. It'll bring you right into the Facebook community. We have new people joining almost every day. We're getting some really great stuff in there. We've definitely got content going every day from all sorts of different parts of the community. We have people literally all over the world in the Facebook community. It's pretty cool, actually, when we get like comments from the Netherlands and stuff. It's like, whoa, that's so neat. Anyway. Or if you want to send us a message directly, if you would like to submit your ideas for episode number facts, you can email me, andrew@thefamilygamers.com.
Yeah, start thinking now about 190, 191, good numbers to have, because we so far have nothing.
I love not having to work on something. I like being lazy, so I would love your feedback.
Help Andrew be lazy. Yes. That's the new tagline.
Yes, 2020. Help Andrew be lazy.
Well, and if you have any questions for me, you can email me at anitra@thefamilygamers.com. Please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on whatever podcast subscription feed you like. Tell your friends about it and leave us a review at Apple Podcast or your subscription source of choice to tell people who aren't your friends about the Family Gamers Podcast.
Mm-hmm. You can also find us on TuneIn, Stitcher, or Spotify.
The Family Gamers Podcast is once again sponsored by First Move Financial. Go to firstmovefinancial.com/familygamers to learn how the team at First Move Financial can help you pile up the victory points.
Thank you to First Move Financial. Well, I think that's going to be it for us this week. Jen, once again, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It was so great to have you.
Thank you for having me. And I'll see you again in real life soon. Hopefully.
Hopefully sooner rather than later. Hopefully we don't have to wait until VannerCon. I mean, hopefully we'll be able to see people in general.
Leave our house again.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Yeah.
Well,
what are people? Who are people?
I don't know. There are these things on the internet. I have no idea. But anyway, until next week, everybody, play games with your kids.